The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of its hosts, guests, or callers, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of WTBR-FM, its management, other producers, or sponsors.
Sunsets by Lavja Tudor. She left her heart in Paris, a kidney in Berlin. In Barcelona, blinking in the sunlight, she felt tiny new ears grow down one side of her face. The sound multiplied. Vale, vale, vale. Rapid fire, Spanish, Catalan, asteroid, pigeon, a robotnik, Becker, shaking coins inside a tin can, begging for change or spare parts, a dog barking, the waves of the Mediterranean breaking against the shore, the cry of a bird, the horn of a cargo ship. She retreated into the coffee shop and ordered chocolate. Hey, lady. Some snot-nosed kid in the corner reading a comic book. He stared at her curiously. Are you an alien? No, Valentina said. I'm from Mars. She felt so tired then. The kid's eyes grew large. Mars? He said. Is that why you... He indicated the growths down the side of her face. Perfect little ears. Four of them, she noticed, when she touched the tips of her finger to the cheek. No, that's just a line barger virus. The kid made a face and retreated into his comic book. She couldn't get over how people on Earth still read from things made out of dead trees, as though trees were commonplace. On Mars, a tree was something rare and precious. Valentina grew up in Yanif Town, deep in the Martian desert, a small place under a small dome. They had one olive tree, planted in the days of settlement in the town square. It was said Busho had rested under its shadow once. People came from all over to see it, from as far as Enid or Port Jessup. She drank the chocolate, deliciously sweet. She couldn't stop marveling at Earth. The only dome was as large as the planet itself. Water fell from the sky. There were 1,000 smells and 1,000 sounds. Earth was too big, too confusing. She stepped out and searched for a nearby organ shop. I can give you 50 créditos per ear, the woman of the organ shop told her. She was a thin, small woman with round glasses, those being a fashion for some reason. She could see perfectly well without them. That seems low, Valentina said. The woman shrugged. Take it or leave it, she said. Valentina just wanted the ears gone, and she needed the money. She nodded. The woman indicated for Valentina to follow her. To the back room and surgical equipment and hearts and spleens and vacuum-sealed containers. The operation only took a moment. The woman shaving off the ears neatly and packing them away. You should have let them grow, the woman said. These are still small, and there's less demand for children's ears. Valentina shrugged. There'll be more, she said. The woman looked at her curiously. Can you control it? She said. I'm in need of a pancreas. Valentina just shook her head. She felt so tired. Can I have my money now? She said. The woman pinged the cash into her node. Valentina thanked her and left. Above her rose Nueva Barcelona, all gleaming skyscrapers reaching for the skies, transparent bridges woven in between them like spider's silk. She found a cheap hotel off Las Ramblas. A four-armed Martian reborn drew a crowd outside as he performed the three-card Monty on an upturned carton. It made her laugh. Another Martian down in the old world. Her left side itched. She could feel a kidney growing. The hotel was a pod hotel, popular with off-worlders. Clocks on the wall above reception showed the time in Tereshkova part and Sarah's prime and Tong Yun. She heard Lunar Chinese and Venusian Hindi. She crawled into her pod, a small, comfortable space, and blessed silence. The gravity was a killer. She closed her eyes. What was she doing on Earth anyway? They say you can catch the perfect sunset. The what? Lying with a mirror in their bed in their co-op building. The perfect sunset, he said, laughing. Not like a Martian sunset with the sun so small. On Earth, it's huge. It fills up the whole sky. I don't know, Valentina said. I don't much care for sunsets. He drew her close to him. He had the smell you never quite got rid of when you worked in the fish tanks underground. Salt, fish, seaweed. She liked it. She nestled close. He said, but I do. It was something she thought about often later, Hamir and the sunsets on Earth. Lots of people had the line barger. It was introduced into the populace centuries back, when hospitals were poor. And for a time, there were public health campaigns, too. Do your part. Help save a life. Grow a kidney. Now it was just a good way to make some extra money, if you didn't mind the inconvenience. Only something had gone wrong. Some form of the virus had mutated inside Amir without either of them realizing it, and he began to grow new organs too fast. They spread over his body like cancer. He sprouted lips from his shoulder, ears on his chest. His stomach bulged with new livers and spleens. As quickly as they were harvested, they regrew. She had to watch him all through that final year. And only when it ended, with Amir barely recognizable under the weight of what he had become, a monstrous growth of misshapen forces and middle inside-out stomachs. Only when he was mercifully given the fatal dose that sent him dreamless into the final dark, was she allowed to grieve. All that remained of him after the harvest was a thin corpse. A ghost collector came from Tong Tan and removed Amir's node to go into the repository at the public heavens. In the Yaniv town cemetery outside the dome, Valentina had a small headstone erected for Amir's physical remains. A robot priest from Port Jessup performed a final ceremony. She had found it hard to grieve, hard to reconcile the man she knew with what he had become. And as she finally cried over him days later in their now empty apartment, a ring of eyes as small as gemstones round her finger wept with her. She tried to get back to her life. She worked in the bug factory outside town, raising grasshoppers and crickets and ants, delicacies packaged and sold across the Martian outback. It was only months later that the message came of Amir's last will and testament, and she realized what he had done, how all the harvested organs piled up in that final year, how he had signed away the rights to his own out-of-control body. The organs tallied up at market price and scattered all around the planet, like dandelion seeds. She imagined parts of Amir in everyone she met, imagined his essence in a farmer of the valley's Marineris, in a climber on Olympus Mons, in a shopkeeper in Tong Yun. He had left her a lump sum, the totality of a body measured out in Martian shekels. It was not a fortune, but it was more than she had ever had to do with as she pleased. Damn him, she thought savagely. She had wanted him to still be there, not this useless money to drink away in Maya Kuri's izakaya or down at the reborn dive that was the water of life. One night, drunk on grief and vodka, She stumbled under the old olive tree and tried to reach Amir. His spirit, when at last it came, was barely a whisper of who he had been. A few jumbled memories, traces of a person recorded in their node. That was usually all you could hope for. The spirit could barely speak words, but accessing the heavens in Tong Yun, Valentina could nevertheless feel a sense of enormous love come through on the connection. And instead of words, she saw a sunrise, glorious and wild, in reds and yellows and pinks, like something that could never be seen on Mars. "Fine," she whispered, and she cut the link. The next day, she took the train to Tong Yun, from there to orbit, and on to Jel Blong Mata, an old ship that did the Mars-to-Earth run. She didn't even like the sun. Valentina thought, lying in the pod, her body feeling the unaccustomed weight. How could she be so heavy? The sun, this ball of flame, too close and hot. Not like the comforting sun of Mars hanging like a lantern in the sky. She tried to sleep, and when sleep at last came, she dreamed of home, of the apartment gathering dust, cats dozing in the town square, the trains passing through the airlock on their way elsewhere. It wasn't much, but it was home, and home had more than adequate sunsets as far as she was concerned. She emerged back into the city as the sun fell down in the sky, but its setting was obscured by buildings. The quality of light changed, though. There was a warmth to Earth sunsets that startled her. And Barcelona was warm, hotter by far than the old cities she had visited up to now, which in their faded grandeur and utter immensity dwarfed even Tong Yun into nothing more than a sleepy backwater on a faraway planet. No one here much cared about Mars. Why would they, when they had this entire world all to themselves? Just exploring Earth would take anyone a lifetime. She saw the Martian warrior still out there dealing out his find-the-lady routine. The oldest tricks were the best, and people gathered around him to try their luck. She watched a while. Some sort of flying machine appeared, lights flashing, and people scattered as the reborn gathered up his makeshift table and his cards and ran for it. She caught up with him a few minutes later in a bar down the street, where the reborn sat for a beer and a plate of octopus and olive oil. Valentina wasn't sure what made her do it, but she went and sat beside him. "Where are you from?" she said. "New Israel," he said. "Kibbutz Repaim, near the Soviet border." He looked up. "You?" he said. "Place called Yanivtown," she said. "How did you know I was Martian?" He smiled. He had a nice smile. "Did you know you have an eye growing on your cheek?" he said. She blinked. A third eye opened. The vision was blurred. "I didn't notice," she said. "Well," he said, answering her earlier question, "you came to talk to me, so I figured..." "Not many people do," she said, surprised. "Not like you did," he said. He pushed the plate into the middle of the table. "You want some?" She realized she was hungry. "Thanks," she said. A waiter came by. She ordered a beer. She dipped bread into the olive oil, scooped up a slice of boiled octopus. Almost no one ate crickets here, she thought. "How long have you been down here?" she asked him. "Earth? 6 months or so. I chased a wild Hongyan in the Gobi when it was laying down cities, then went into the drift." He shrugged. "I saw the Taj Mahal, the pyramids too, the usual. I did some casual work in Neom. What about you?" "I'm looking for a sunset," she said. "A sunset, huh? I get that." "You do?" She must have looked surprised because he laughed. "I love sunsets," he said. "What's your name anyway?" she said. And two, he said. Your real name, she said. I mean, you know. My name before I... This, he said. Four hands gesturing. Red skin, grafted arms, the lot. He smiled. Before I heard the call of the Emperor of Time, of Mars that never was. Right. Sammy, he said. I'm Valentina. Nice to meet you, Valentina, he said. So where do I find one, she said. Find what? Sammy said. A sunset. Everywhere, he said. It was his turn to look surprised. He touched her cheek gently. You have another eye growing there, he said. I tried, she said. I tried to find a sunset he would like, but they all look just the same. Maybe it's not where the sunset is, he said. It's what you are when you get there. I wish I could see them the way you do, she said. He said I could try to show you. The airship glided over the Atlantic, the coast of Africa far on their left. They boarded in Barcelona, flew over Valencia and Granada, and now sailed toward the Islas Canarias, which the Apollo 11 astronauts visited after coming back from the moon, Sammy said. Not many people know that. You're full of surprises, Valentina said. They saw Earthrise, Sammy said, but they came back for the sunsets. Why are you traveling? She said. If you're a reborn... Mars that never was is always there, he said. I wanted to see other places for a while. To Valentina, Sammy's old Mars was just a shared world simulation, no different to the guilds of Ashkelon or other game worlds where people often spent their lives. To the reborn, though, it was more real than the physicality, a place in some parallel past where the Emperor of Time held sway and brought them back to their true selves, warriors in his service. Their Mars had breathable air and beautiful canals. It had glorious sunsets. She realized with some surprise that she enjoyed hearing him talk. Eyes grew on her forehead and the back of her hand. They flourished on her cheeks. Small at first, they opened. She thought about Amir, who never got to visit Earth, never got to see those sunsets. Each night, the sun fell down into the ocean, swallowed by the waves, and the sky was lit with an enormity of colors. She watched it every night, and all her eyes were open, and each night the seeing was the same, and each night it was different. Amir would have liked it, she thought. When the airship reached Maspalomas at last, Valentina went back to land with mixed feelings. At an organ shop near the beach, nestled between a church of robot node and a mojito bar, she had her extra eyes shaved off. She was sorry to let them go, for they had seen something in a way she hadn't before. Her skin smooth again, she walked along the sea, alone, her feet sinking into the wet, warm sand. She thought of Mars then, knew that she would go back soon. She thought of Collins, Buzz, and Neil as they came back to Earth and must have visited this shore, where once an ancient relay antenna helped them reach the moon, long before anyone built a golf course there. It must have felt strange to them as it did to her, now being here with all that sand and all that sea and sky. Children built castles to hold against the tide. An elderly couple collected crabs in a rock pool. Valentina stepped into the ocean and felt the water lapping at her ankles and stood there with the warm wind on her skin. She let go of something then and felt lighter, as though she had buried a heart in the sand. And then she watched the sky, as without any hurry, the earth rotated on its axis and began to swallow up its star. There's Nothing in the Attic by Faith Marino. The first night it was a kitchen chair sat neatly on top of the polished walnut table, which the father had ordered from a luxury furniture dealer around the same time the nanny came to live with the family in the new grated tract home development, where the identical sameness of the terracotta tile roofs and blue lawns made walks through the neighborhood disorienting and panic-inducing, so that many often had to use GPS to find a way home. The nanny was the first one up that morning, thus the first to discover the chair on the table. The other chairs were neatly pushed in. No disorder in the room, as if the chair had simply floated itself onto the table. And it looked so silly that the nanny laughed and took it down before plugging in the Mr. Coffee and wiping the grounds off the quartz countertop. She and the father usually woke at the same time, and for the first month after the baby was born, they had an unspoken agreement that whosoever went into the kitchen first had to make the coffee. But the nanny had noticed over the last few weeks that she was always the one who ended up in the kitchen first, just like she'd notice that when she started taking out the trash, the father seemed to just stop taking it out. And now she made the coffee and took out the trash, even though she was only getting paid to take care of the baby. And even then, she'd only been hired to help in the mornings and evenings, leaving time in the afternoon to attend classes at the community college so she could get her associate's degree in child development and transfer in 2 years. But her father had asked her a week into the spring semester to drop her classes until the baby was sleeping through the night, which might be never. When the father came into the kitchen that morning in his ironed white shirt and tie, she said, "Good one," hooking a thumb at the table. He blinked and then laughed and said, "I try," in that way that he did when he was pretending to understand a joke. The next night, it was 3 loud knocks on the front door. The sister-in-law was the only one who heard it, and she ran down the gray, high-piled carpeted stairs to the foyer, both of which were identical in every tract home in the development. She and her sister, the wife, had gone to enough open house tours in the neighborhood to know that every house in the gated community had an identical layout: stained concrete foyer, stairs to the left, sitting room to the right, living room straight ahead, and kitchen capping the corner between them. She peered through the peephole in the door, but the patio was dark. She opened the door and whispered, "Hello?" into the night air, wondering if the teenage stepdaughter was pulling a prank on them, even though she wasn't the type to prank. The sprinklers across the street were running, and the wet sidewalk was haloed white under the fluorescent streetlights. The shadow of a cat slunk over the neighbor's fence, even though outdoor cats were a CC&R violation in the gated community. No one answered. Too jittery to go back to sleep, the sister-in-law went into the kitchen and prepared a batch of orange cream cinnamon rolls for breakfast, her own recipe and the father's favorite. The kitchen was quiet, so she played music on her phone while she kneaded and rolled the dough. But as she cut the log into discs, she thought she heard a tap-tap at the kitchen window. The third night, it was footsteps in the attic, slow and dragging, and the wife tried to get the father to go look, but he mumbled that he didn't hear anything and rolled away from her, So she put on her flip-flops, went out to the hallway, and pulled down the stepladder cord. She'd been hearing strange noises in the night ever since they'd moved into the house, right before she had the baby. Knocks on the walls, chairs scudding downstairs in the kitchen. The father said it was just hormones, her body on alert for danger, an evolutionary adaptation to protect her and the baby from predators in those vulnerable first months. He'd watched a documentary on Neanderthals on the Discovery Channel. She was climbing the steps when the teenage stepdaughter's bedroom door opened. "Mom?" she whispered, leaning out her door in the "Everyone Loves Someone Who's Had an Abortion" t-shirt that she slept in. "Did you hear it too?" 16, the same age the wife was when she gave birth to the stepdaughter. "Go back to bed," the wife whispered as she climbed the steps. But the stepdaughter was there with her, iPhone flashlight, and she passed it up to the wife as the sister-in-law and the nanny came out of their rooms because they, too, had heard the footsteps in the attic. The wife shined the light around the dark, warm space, and she was surprised by how clean it was. No cobwebs, no dust, just blankets of pillowy insulation. "There's nothing here," she said, and then looked down at the others. "There's nothing in the attic." The next morning, the father laughed and shook his head as he poured the coffee that the nanny had made. "Haunted?" he said. "The house is haunted? By who? Whom?" The stepdaughter corrected. "This house is brand new. No one died in this house, and it's not sitting on some old burial ground." He made a puffing sound as he added creamer to his coffee. "How would the ghost even know which house is which?" "There's something," the wife said as she misted the succulent leaves she was propagating in a Tupperware container on the counter. "We all heard it last night." The father laughed and shook his head again. "There's no such thing as ghosts." Still, the wife bought devotional candles and lit them around the house. The nanny used a small, squeezy bottle of holy water to splash the doors and windows, while the sister-in-law hung her childhood rosaries and crucifixes on the walls. The wife lit a sage stick and wafted the smoke around the house until the nanny said it was cultural appropriation, and the wife put it out in a bowl of water. But the ghostly activity continued. They heard knocks on the walls, three sharp raps right above their heads as they were reading or cleaning or making dinner. Opened windows were closed, and closed windows were opened. Doors were locked and unlocked. A vase of flowers was left balancing precariously on an Italian leather sofa cushion. And always, every night, they heard the sound of dragging footsteps in the attic. The stepdaughter brought out the Ouija board she'd been hiding in her closet since she was 13 and placed it on the bright hand-carved mango wood coffee table. The women gathered around it and placed their fingertips on the edge of the planchette. "Spirit, we call on thee to reveal thyself," the stepdaughter said, eyes closed. "You can just talk normally," the wife said. "It works better this way." "How do you know?" the nanny asked. "Just, okay, can we just..." The stepdaughter cleared her throat and rolled her shoulders as she closed her eyes again. "Spirit, reveal thyself." The women waited in breathless silence, eyes closed. The air conditioner clicked on, and the dog moaned as he stretched on the kitchen floor. And then the planchette began to drift, floating slowly across the board as the woman spelled out the letters H-E-L-L. Oh. Nope, then Annie said, withdrawing her hands and standing. I'm out. You can't quit now, the stern law said. Nope, then Annie said, shaking imaginary dirt off her hands as she walked away. I've seen this movie. She picked up the baby, who was having tummy time on a blanket on the floor, and carried him into the kitchen. Let's just keep going without her, the wife said. They all closed their eyes again, and the stepdaughter cracked her neck. Spirit, what is thy name? Stillness. Silence. And then the planchette began to move, and the women spelled out the letters I-A-M. Are you serious? The father was standing in the foyer, sleeves rolled up to his elbows and suit jacket over his arm. What are you doing? The women stared, uncomprehending, until the stepdaughter said, communing with the spirits, waving a hand at the Ouija board. Obviously. Where is the baby? The father asked. Right there, the wife said, pointing at the nanny and the baby at the kitchen table. A muscle twitched in the father's cheek. Why aren't you watching him? He's right there, the wife said, pointing. The father moved swiftly into the sitting room and folded up the Ouija board. No more of this. I don't want to hear any more bull about ghosts and haunted houses. He was sweating, peak-chinked, his Dutch blood unable to handle the late summer heat, even though it stayed fairly mild in the valley. It's not bull, the sister-in-law said as she tried to push the father's hands away. Show me the proof, the father said, picking up the Ouija board that was sticking half out of the box. Show me scientific evidence for the existence of ghosts, and then you can have all the seances you want. So the women Googled ghosts, which led them to YouTube videos about multiverse bleed-throughs and the mysteries of consciousness, which led them to podcasts and audiobooks on Jungian philosophy and the collective unconscious, which led them to research articles on quantum mechanics and particle physics. The wife checked out library books on neutrinos, the subatomic ghost particles that have no mass or electrical charge and can pass through solid objects. The sister-in-law listened to audiobooks on string theory and space-time, while the nanny used the Community College online library database to download and print articles from scientific journals about general relativity versus special relativity. The teenage stepdaughter watched YouTube videos on black holes and the light spectrum, and when the sister-in-law burst into the stepdaughter's room and said, "A spoon is a quantum of movement," the stepdaughter replied, "Color is the movement of light." The father woke in the morning to find the coffee made and the trash taken out and the nanny reading so intently at the kitchen table that she didn't say hello to him when he came in. He poured his coffee, made his toast, fried his eggs, all the while watching the nanny to see whether she'd notice him and say, "Good morning." He sat across from her at the table where she sat hunched over her book like she was trying to see through it. And he stared at her while he ate his breakfast. He put the dirty plate and coffee mug in the sink and lingered a moment in the doorway. But the nanny never looked up, so he left. Later that day, he came home from work to find the stepdaughter slicing ever smaller segments of string in half with an X-Acto knife and a pair of tweezers at the kitchen counter, hair in her eyes and forehead jeweled with sweat. He poured himself a glass of water, waiting for her to say hello, and when she didn't, he asked, "What are you doing with that string?" She replied without looking at him, "Seeing how many times I can cut it in half until it no longer exists." That evening, while the sister-in-law browned ground beef in a pan at the stove, she told the wife about matrix mechanics. Electrons disappear between jumps. In the split second when they move from one atom to another, they can't be located in time or space. She scraped the frozen brick of beef and flipped it, pressing it into the pan with the spatula. They only exist when colliding with something else. That night, the father brushed his teeth and came to bed, where his wife was reading in her Oxnard Bulldogs t-shirt and boxers. And she looked up from her book on the curvature of space-time and said, eyes bright, "We're all living in a giant cosmic mollusk." The father froze at the edge of the bed with a semi, because the wife wasn't wearing a bra, and said, "The hell is a mollusk?" The wife's eyes dulled, and she shook her head as she turned back to her book. The next morning, the coffee wasn't made, and the father came into the kitchen to find a wristwatch on the counter and another one on the floor. He bent to pick it up, but the nanny jumped from the kitchen chair she was reading in to shout, "Don't touch it!" "Why not?" "Because time is relative to distance. So by the end of the day, the watch on the floor should be slower than the watch on the counter," the nanny explained. "Also, can you take out the trash when you leave?" By fall, a whiteboard had gone up in the sitting room with diagrams and arrows and formulas written in red marker. ML plus M triangle X equals 0, along with several bullet points. Matrix mechanics, between jumps, electrons disappear, cease to exist, ... only versed matter, only existing collusion, one electron theory, zags backward in time, positron, antimatter, all bodies attract other bodies, curvature of space-time. The knocks on the walls continued. Even the father heard them now, unmistakably intentional. Three quick raps. Someone knocking on a door. But he pretended not to notice, and he didn't meet the wife's eyes when she heard the knocks and looked at him across the room. The wife started batting his exploring hand away at night, and he told his business partner over golf that she wasn't acting like herself. She was remote, distant. "And there's a live-in nanny?" the business partner asked. "A baby always puts stress on a marriage, and the wife usually changes and becomes distant, but usually it's because she's tired and stressed out. But if she's got a nanny helping her..." "And her sister and daughter," the father added. The business partner had warned him about the pressure that a baby could put on a marriage, which was why the father had insisted on hiring the nanny in the first place. The business partner made a face. "Four women and one baby? She can't be that tired." The business partner had married his college girlfriend and now had a 4-year-old daughter and a 2-year-old son. The father was the only one who knew that the business partner had slept with a woman he met in a bar in Denver last spring when they went to Colorado to bid on a job. He knew because he found the business partner sobbing and squatting in the hotel hallway outside his door in his boxers and undershirt, crying as hard as he did the night he found out his wife had gone into labor 7 weeks early with their son while he was in Miami. And he knew it would be at least 2 days until he could get back to her. "You need to take her out for a date night," the business partner yelled over the wind as he steered their golf cart to the next hole. "Make her feel like something other than a mom for a night." So that night the father took the wife out to the same restaurant where they'd met when she was a bartender, because he knew she liked seeing her old friends there. The bartender that night was the same woman who called in sick the night the father came in and met the wife, who was covering her shift. The wife ran behind the bar and hugged her. The father swirled his greyhound and watched them catch up, imagining what would have happened if the other woman had been tending the bar when he'd come, if he would have fallen in love and married her instead of the wife. The thought made him uneasy. The wife and the other woman looked so similar, he could imagine himself getting drunk and not being able to tell the difference between the two, which made him wonder how easy it would be to cheat like the business partner did. He looked away when they both laughed too loudly, tucking their chins so that their necks waddled in a way he'd always found unattractive. When the wife came back to the table, he said, "I'm ready to order if you are." He ordered a steak with a baked potato and gravy, while the wife ordered a plate of French fries, switchback style. And when the father asked what that meant, she waved a hand and said, "I used to double fry my fries when my shift was over. I'd switch them back and forth from the flour mixture to the frying oil, so now everyone here calls it switchback style. You're only going to eat French fries? You should at least have a vegetable or something." Potatoes are vegetables. He didn't like hearing her old work stories and seeing her in this context. A restaurant worker, a person who ate a plate of French fries on its own like she'd just worked a late shift. And he'd decided before their food arrived that he wouldn't bring her back here again. "So tell me the latest," he said after several minutes of silence. As if anticipating the question, the wife sipped her Coke and said, "Well, matrix mechanics is more plausible, but I'm really drawn to the one electron universe. And I don't think both can be true at the same time. But then lots of things in quantum mechanics and particle physics manage to be true even when they contradict each other." The father blinked, swallowed his steak thickly. "What?" She swept the tabletop clear with both hands. "Unlike other particles, every electron is identical." She lined up identical Splenda packets on the table between them. "The one electron universe theory asks the question, what if they're actually all the same electron?" She swept all but one Splenda packet away with her hand. "What if the entire universe is made up of only one electron, moving rapidly back and forth through time, zigzagging so fast it seems to make a picture? But we can only see one half of the easel, so we can only see one side of the picture." She put the condiments tray in between them and zigzagged the remaining Splenda packet from side to side on the table so that the father could only see the left zag she made. But the hand on the Splenda packet froze. "Time reversed matter is antimatter, which means we're not really here. It's all an illusion." Smiling as she tossed the Splenda packet over her shoulder so that it landed on the floor behind her. The father felt the steak lodge in his throat, and he sipped his water to try to move it. He waited a breathless, terrifying 6 seconds before feeling the wedge of steak loosen and pass. "Isn't that beautiful?" the wife asked. "That you and me and the table and the chairs, everyone in this restaurant, could all be made up of the same single electron. That we're all part of the same body." "The same body?" the father asked, eyes watering. The wife put her hand on his because he realized she thought he was crying. "The same illusion of a body," she said, smiling. The father motioned for the waiter and asked for the check. The next day, the father microwaved a Costco teriyaki bowl for himself after work because the sister-in-law had forgotten to make dinner, and he sat at the table to find the wife, the nanny, the sister-in-law, and the stepdaughter out on the Kentucky bluegrass lawn in the backyard at sunset. They were gathered around the baby's swing, which had been tied to the lowest branch of the oak tree that had already dropped its leaves for winter. The stepdaughter climbed a stepstool ladder until she was parallel with the branch, and then the nanny passed the baby in the swing to her. The stepdaughter held the swing for a moment while the other women timed their watches, and then she released it. The baby, now 6 months old, screamed with joy as he swung down and then up again, this time only half the distance of the rope to the branch. The women waited until the swing stopped moving before they released their timers and then cheered at their successful experiment. The father came home from work the next day to find the sister-in-law taking out the trash and the wife in the kitchen making a tuna melt sandwich that she put on a plate and carried to the nanny, who was reclining on the couch watching TV. The nanny took a bite and said, "A little bit of mustard next time." I thought so, too, the wife said. The father fired the nanny. He put her suitcase in the trunk and drove her to her mother's house himself. He said he would mail her a check for the last 2 weeks' pay, but they both knew he wouldn't. And when he came home, the wife, the sister-in-law, and the teenage stepdaughter were all waiting in the foyer, staring at him, not with hatred or anger, but rather with a hardness, a resignation. I'm not going to pay someone to sit around watching TV and getting spoon-fed, the father said louder than he'd intended. He was prepared for one of them to snap back that they were surprised he paid her at all. They knew he refused to pay the contractor he'd hired to update his parents' house after they died, citing shoddy workmanship, before selling the house for a profit. He paid for a trip to Hawaii for the whole family with the money he refused to pay the landscapers, while he accused of cutting corners to pocket the extra cash. He would admit what the others in the house couldn't, that this was how they were able to live the life they had, in a new tract home in the San Fernando Valley with a pool that overlooked the valley beyond, in a neighborhood with a gate and guard shack, good schools, shopping centers, grocery stores stocked with organic fair trade products, restaurants that served everything so families didn't have to argue about where to eat. But to his surprise, the wife, the sister-in-law, and the stepdaughter didn't say anything. They turned away, the sister-in-law going out to the backyard to sit in a lounge chair by the covered pool, while the stepdaughter went upstairs to her room, and the wife went to the living room to lie on the floor with the baby. The sister-in-law stopped talking to the father and made dinner that she served the wife and stepdaughter before he got home. There was always enough left over for him, but he knew that there was an insult in it anyway. And then one Friday afternoon, he found her carrying the baby through the backyard, whispering to him, "All one electron." He told his sister-in-law it was time for her to move out. "You've been here for almost a year. It's time to get your own place," the father said. "This weekend, right now." "I'm working this weekend," she said. The father knew that the sister-in-law had rearranged her schedule so that she could help with the baby in the afternoon and make dinner at night, but he was too angry to give it any more thought. "Now, this weekend, out," he said. The sister-in-law was gone by Sunday. The wife and the stepdaughter whispered in corners and doorways, flashing out of sight when the father appeared. Neither would look him in the eye, and the wife started sleeping on a yoga mat in the nursery because she said the baby was going through a sleep regression, but the father never heard him crying. The wife started bartending again, picking up shifts after the stepdaughter got home from school to take care of the baby. "No," the father said when he found the wife putting on her restaurant uniform in the bedroom while the stepdaughter waited in the hallway with the baby. "No bartending. You're a mother." "I can be a mother and a bartender," the wife said. "You need to be home with the baby." "I am home with the baby. All day," the wife said, putting in her earrings. She walked out and took the baby from the stepdaughter, who whispered, "He's a black hole," staring at him, knowing he could hear her. So the father got off work early to pick up the stepdaughter from school with a duffel bag of her things. He drove her an hour and a half south to drop her at her grandparents' double-wide in Riverside, but not before taking her phone, which was on the family plan he paid for, which meant it was actually his phone. When he got home and told the wife, she wept. She begged the father to let the stepdaughter come home, at least to finish out the school year. She promised to quit her job, but he said, "Prove it. Prove that you love me." The wife knew that the father was ruthless, determined, single-minded. His anger sometimes showed itself in ways that scared her, like when the landscaping foreman showed up at the house demanding his money, and the father said, "What will happen to your company if I make a call to ICE?" And she knew he would. He would break up a dozen families if it meant winning. Once someone had become his enemy, he showed no mercy. She tried to be good, but everything she did enraged him. She set a watch on the floor and another one on the top of the bookcase, and the father snatched them up and said, "Enough of this." He took the baby's swing off the oak branch so the wife would stop her pendulum experiments. There came a knock, knock, knock one night from the garage door while they were sitting on the couch watching TV, and the father pretended not to hear it. "You heard it," the wife said. "I didn't hear anything," the father said. "The garage." So the father stood and went to the door, opening it, shining his phone flashlight inside the dark garage. "See? Nothing." "The observer effect," the wife said. "What?" "When you shine a light on an unlit object, you change it. The photons bounce it in a new direction," she explained. "By looking for the ghost, you change the ghost's location." "Jeez, enough with the ghosts," the father yelled, and slammed the garage door hard enough to rattle the wall and wake the baby. When the knock, knock, knock came from the ceiling directly over their bed that night, they both sat up and looked at one another wild-eyed. "You heard it," the wife said. "I didn't hear anything," the father said. "You heard it," the wife insisted. "From the attic." "There's nothing in the attic," the father said. The wife opened her mouth to speak, and the father grabbed her by the throat, not to hurt her, not to crush out her breath, simply to silence her. He wanted her to stop speaking. He wanted things to go back to the way they were before. He wanted the wife he had before. He only let go when a thunderous boom came from the ceiling, and he and the wife both gasped. The wife was shaking. The father exhaled slowly and lay down. "Go back to sleep," he said, rolling away from her. The wife stopped eating. She stopped cooking and cleaning. She bumped into walls and tables because she no longer saw them. She drifted through the house with the baby during the day, and at night she floated through the empty rooms and whispered to him. The father once heard her say, "Time accelerates in a black hole." He followed her from room to room, but every time he turned on the light, she seemed to jump into a different space. He followed her to the kitchen, watched her turn on the faucet in the dark, and when he turned on the light, she was gone, faucet still running. She reappeared in the hallway and drifted into the bathroom, and when he ran after her and turned on the bathroom light, she vanished. The baby monitor crackled on the kitchen counter. She was upstairs, whispering to the baby. He turned the volume on the monitor to max and put it to his ear to hear her whisper through the attic, whisper through the static, "All one electron." The father did what he did as a last resort. He didn't want to do it. He didn't want to lock her in the attic, but she gave him no choice. He was out of options. She didn't even seem to notice as he guided her up the ladder, pushing her butt from behind. She didn't yell or weep, didn't try to push back or fight her way out. She just sat in the chair he left for her and watched as he closed the door and nailed it shut. The wife knew something about luck. A high school dropout with a baby at 16. The only reason she was in the attic of this 3,000-square-foot house, in a development of identical 3,000-square-foot homes, was because she happened to cover a bartending shift for a sick co-worker the night the father came into the restaurant. He'd come in a few times before, his hair slightly disheveled in a careful, attentive way, and he'd flirted with the other bartender. He was 4 tequila shots in before she understood that he thought she was the other bartender. He stayed until her shift ended and she called him a cab. He took her hand, eyes swimming, and said, "Can I show you my house?" She said yes and clocked out. She was young and pretty. He was ready to settle down and start a family. When the father refused to pay the contractors and landscapers and pool cleaners and merry maids, she pretended not to see. When he met her eye, challenging her to push back and tell him it was wrong, so that he could tell her she was naive and this was the way of the world, she looked away. And as she climbed the ladder with the father pushing from behind, as the door was nailed shut, she knew that she'd chosen the attic, that she'd always been in the attic. The father knew the importance of narrative continuity and how important it was to keep the story of a house consistent, how everything could fall apart when enough light showed between the rafters and the joists. So he showered, brushed his teeth, ironed his shirt, dabbed cologne under his jaw, buckled the baby into the car seat, and went back to the restaurant to find the other bartender. After several days of being alone in the dark, warm, windowless room, the wife realized she was disappearing. If she didn't move, if she stayed perfectly still, she could no longer feel the floor or the walls. She couldn't tell where her body ended and the house began. She was floating up to the rafters. She was sinking through the floor. She started pacing slowly back and forth across the attic, feet heavy and dragging because she didn't know where they were. Back and forth, back and forth. She crawled into the walls and knocked on them to locate herself in time and space. She became a pendulum, measuring the house's heartbeats as she moved backward and forward through time. And after a while, she couldn't be sure if she was still in her own house or if she wasn't haunting someone else's home. She realized that it wasn't her knocking on the walls, but a different ghost in a different house. She realized that she could come and go as she wanted. She liked going back to the moment of the Ouija board, seeing how far she could get before the father interrupted. She opened the windows and locked doors, stroked her daughter's hair, tickled her baby's chin. She put chairs on top of tables and vases and vases on couch cushions because she now knew how much it truly frightened the father, how she could unmake him with a single hard blow to the ceiling right above his head. Father never stopped hearing her footsteps in the attic, and one night he pried out the nails and pulled open the door to peer inside. The attic was empty, but he knew the wife wasn't gone. She'd just become antimatter. And later, when the new wife woke up in the night and whispered, "Did you hear that? It sounded like footsteps in the attic." The father wasn't actually lying when he said, "There's nothing in the attic."